Longing for light, we wait in darkness. Longing for truth, we turn to you. Make us your own, your holy people, light for the world to see. Amen. You remember the TV show Mission Impossible? And how each episode began? Or maybe you saw the movie. A tape recording would describe some tricky riddle to solve, or threat to defuse, or danger to thwart. And then, after the agent was given his instructions, the device would self-destruct. A little fire would start to smolder and set off a fuse, which traveled across the bottom of the screen. Dum dum da da dum dum da da dum dum da da dum dum da da dum da da. That's a little of how I understand Jesus' declaration here, 12 verses into the Sermon on the Mount. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to be salt and light. The only difference is that on the TV show, the hero or heroine was always given the option to decline the assignment. But God doesn't give us a way out. You are the salt of the earth, Jesus says straight up. You are the light of the world. And this is much more than a personal ethic. The Sermon on the Mount is the constitution of a new community that Jesus inaugurates. A redefinition, really, of what it means to be human. It's a description of what it looks like for a people to be in shalom, to be at peace, to get it right, finally, with each other, with other groups, and with God. And when folks live this way, Jesus suggests, they are salt for a humanity grown tasteless. Light for a world that spends too much of its time in the dark. Preservative for a way of being that is otherwise quite likely to die. If we were asked to guess the kind of people that Jesus would select for special commendation in his most famous sermon, we might be tempted to say a standout hero of one sort or another. Men and women with impressive credentials, morally, spiritually, professionally, and every which way. Bold-faced names. But that's not quite right. Maybe those people aren't the ones that Jesus picked out because he felt they didn't need the shot in the arm that his endorsement might give them. Maybe they're not the ones he picked out because he really didn't know anyone who was that fancy or famous. Or maybe he knew that strength always comes from struggle. Insight always comes from a time of blindness. Courage from loss. Wisdom from pain. Whatever the reason, it's worth noting the ones that he did single out. Not the spiritual giants, but the poor in spirit, as he called them. The ones with nothing left to give and everything to receive. Like the prodigal coming home to himself, and his dad dropping everything to run out to him. Not the champions of faith who can rejoice even in the midst of suffering, but the ones like most of us who mourn over our bad luck and our bad choices, even as we discover the part that we've played in bringing it down. Not the strong ones, but the meek ones, the gentlefolk like Charlie Brown, who expose conflict and somehow make the world more human in the process. Not the ones who are righteous already, but the ones who hope to be righteous one day, and in the meantime are well aware that the distance that they still have to go might be greater than the distance they've already come. Not the winners of great victories in some world conflict or even over sin in their own lives, but the ones who see weakness in themselves every time they check their breath or their bank account, every time they comb their thinning or colored hair in front of the mirror, but they keep at it because they know about weakness and they know how to be merciful when they see weakness in others. Not the totally pure, but the pure in heart, who are as shop-worn and clay-footed as the rest of us, yet hang on to some freshness and still have a measure of their innocence intact. Not the ones who have necessarily found peace in its fullness, but the ones who try to bring it about wherever and however they can. Peace with their neighbors, peace for their family, peace in themselves and with God. Those are the blessed called out in the Sermon on the Mount, the event that we drop into in the gospel this morning with the show already started. Coming in at verse 13, it can be kind of tough to make sense of it. We're like the good-natured but noisy little old ladies who sat down in front of me and my wife 2 minutes into the movie Braveheart years ago. You'll remember in the movie, the scene opens with the main character taking a break from the battlefield and literally stepping into the arms of a decidedly naked woman. 12 sentences into the movie, and he's in the midst of making love with this beautiful creature whom he's just met. And picture these ladies again. They're getting their drinks and their popcorn and their bottoms settled into their seats. And the ladies coming in late look up right at that moment of that intimate scene, and they say, "Oh my." And one went on to say, "Lordy, we're later than we thought. We must have missed their wedding." Context matters. And sometimes you have to look back over your shoulder to figure out where you are right now. In his most distinctive central teaching in Matthew, Jesus talks about the blessed in a very particular way. He puts himself on the side of the outsiders, of those who aren't doing very well. "Blessed are the poor in spirit and those who mourn," he says, "the wounded, the weary, the broken and the brokenhearted, and all those who enter into the solidarity with the pain of the world instead of trying to extract themselves from it." So when Jesus says this morning, "You are the salt of the earth and you are the light of the world," he's speaking about our blessed brokenness. We may be masters of the universe on the surface, but God comes to us at our most scruffy, our most wounded, most hidden, most shameful, most awkward, most silent, most hurting, most blessed selves. And believe it or not, it's from there that our flavor emanates. It's from there that the light shines. More than anything else, Jesus is a teacher of vulnerability. And in that, he invites us not to run from what is dark and fearsome in us and around us, but instead to see that God is running to us precisely there, in that context. It's not easy. Henry Nouwen writes, "We no longer have to ask ourselves if we are approaching a state of emergency. We're in the midst of one right here and now. Think of the poor and the jobless. Think of the places of conflict near and far. Think of the people wounded by racism and classism and xenophobia. And it's in the midst of this dark world that we're invited to live and radiate hope." Is it possible? Can we become light, salt, and leaven to our brothers and sisters in our complex human family? Can we offer hope and courage and confidence to the people of this complicated era? Do we dare break through our own judgment and fear? Will the people be able to say about us, "See, look how they love. Look how they serve their neighbor and the stranger and the so-called enemy. Look at how they pray and sing"? Or do we have to confess that at this juncture of history, we just don't have the needed strength or the generosity of spirit to love across all the lines that we live in, party lines or national borders or racial divides or class differences? You see, the question that Jesus poses in the Sermon on the Mount, remember, we don't get to decline the mission. And the question is, how can we live so with hope so as to give hope as I read it, it's not optional. How can we live in hope so as to give hope? If you're like me, blessing is often where I least expect it. And consistently, the midwife of my joy is loss. Life is always born through some kind of death or another. Light shines out of the darkness, I guess, because otherwise we wouldn't see it. Andy Blauer writes, "There's a wretched place that depression drags me off to after taking control of my thoughts and feelings. It's the place where the longing for relief mutes every other desire, even the desire to wake up in the morning. There are days," he says, "when I wonder if I'll lose everything, my job, my relationships, my last stitch of sanity. It feels like I'm breathing hot black smoke. Yet I also believe the same depressions that pin me to the mat serve a bigger purpose in my life. They don't come empty-handed. They open a space in me. They open a space in me to hold my own pain and to hold the suffering of others." And that discovery is like the scene in The Matrix when Neo finally understands his identity. You remember, through the whole film, he's been beaten up by evil agents, but the fighting transforms him. And at the right time, he understands and uses his power. And he's peaceful, even when confronting an opponent. Blauer writes, "I believe my own years of struggling have left me with similar gifts, inner strength and calm that I can rely on, diminished fear and compassion. I believe that the painful nights that close in on all of us in some form can be cocoons from which we might shed our weaknesses. When the dark comes," he concludes, "I'll stand up and breathe deeply, knowing that I am becoming through it the person I was born for and which the world needs me to be." It may be that when we no longer know what to do, that that's when we've come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, that we've come to our real journey. "The mind that is not baffled is not employed," writes Wendell Berry. "The impeded stream is the one that sings." Context matters. And no matter the daunting fear, whatever the conflict or controversy, God made us for this moment. How can we be salt and light? By no longer running from our own darkness, by seeing in the struggles our common humanity, by breaking bread with those we call enemy, by building bridges and no more walls. Amen.